welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, and on irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I was trying to think of a theme for this week's show, and given that tomorrow is February 1st, which, as some of you know, is St. Bridget's Day, and St. Bridget is probably one of the best known religious figures associated with Ireland, second only probably to St. Patrick. And St. Bridget's Day, I want to, you know, think maybe a little bit less focus on the religious aspect and just to think of tomorrow, Lá é le bhríde, St. Bridget's Day, as an important date, typically and historically, in the Irish calendar in the past, in that it marked a traditional festival which demarcated the year and the seasons to some extent. It was anciently known as Imbolc, and it was named after Bridget, who was the 5th century abbess of Kildare. Some of you would be familiar with the St. Bridget's Cross. Indeed, I have a St. Bridget's Cross hanging in my own home, which really reminds me of the folkloric traditions of Ireland, less as a religious symbol as such strictly. But these traditionally, the St. Bridget's Cross would be woven out of rushes and is used to bring luck to a home. A dear friend of mine a few years ago sent me a St. Bridget's Cross, and I was delighted to reignite and remember my interest in some of these old ancient traditions of Ireland that have come into the 20th and 21st century. Some of you will also be familiar with the Brat's Vrede, which was the St. Bridget's mantle, which was left outdoors on the eve of the festival and was seen to give women relief in labour, or was to seen to, if they were having problems conceiving, that it would help them or that it would protect their virginity. Indeed, there are lots of associations with the Brat's Vrede. There was also a tradition of the Vridoige, or the Biddies, which was a procession of young people carrying an effigy of the saint from door to door. And the day was traditionally marked by pilgrimages to the many holy wells dedicated to her, many of which were thought to cure sterility. And one of the well-known ones would be that of Brideswell in County Roscommon. As someone who's a historian who was trained in Bailidis, the spoken word and the folklore and the ethnography of Ireland, I find the meshing of some of these religious celebrations with the folkloric festivals and markings of these days of the year is really interesting in terms of how they have persisted. And again, in thinking of my theme for today's show, folks, I thought of St. Bridget, one of, as I would say, the best known of Irish nuns, and I wanted to link it into something that I thought would be interesting to listen to on the day that's in it. And what I'm referring to is, again, in keeping with the notion of the religious link there, my colleague Linda Dowling-Almeida, who's actually going to have a chat to me a little bit later in the programme about her editorship of the American Journal of Irish Studies and about the newest volume of the American Journal of Irish Studies. We're going to talk about the various articles that have been published in this lovely publication recently. But a few months ago, Linda pulled together a fascinating collection of interview excerpts into a podcast called Sisters in Service. So it's about the Catholic nuns in the United States, and specifically the teaching nuns in the United States in the post-war period. So as I said, I'm really giving a shout out to the Irish and Irish American women out there. As we think of Lá Éil Uí Bhriige and we think of the impact that teaching nuns have had on so many people here in the United States, as well as in Ireland, of course, over recent centuries. So I'd like you to enjoy this podcast, which goes into the archive in the Duxbury Ireland House Oral History Collection and pulls out some really fascinating insights into the lives of the nuns who busied themselves with teaching students over decades in this country. I also would like to remind you folks that our public event series is officially, it's kicked off. It actually kicked off yesterday evening with our first Blarney Star concert with Marie Riley from the consulate, who was down to an enthusiastic crowd. And our official regular Thursday evening public events will take place. The first one is on Thursday, February 12th at 7 p.m. Colm Tobin is going to come and talk about his New York Times Book Review bestseller, Nora Webster. So if any of you are interested, that's at 7 p.m. on Thursday, February 12th. Okay, well, sit back and enjoy Sisters in Service, and then we're going to have Linda Dowling-Almeida have a chat to us about the American Journal of Irish Studies.
Well, we had some nuns. We had some sisters, and I remember Sister John Dominic from the fourth grade and Sister Florian from the seventh grade. They both were very nice to me.
Mary Murphy, journalist.
I think we got a really good foundation at the school. I mean, my religion has been a big part of my life. My mother has a lot of faith. You know, she always made sure we got to Mass, and we're thankful for what we had and prayed for help with things that we were seeking.
Good morning, sister. For generations of Catholics and a few non-Catholics, that greeting began the school day for most of their academic life. In active parish communities, crossing paths with a religious sister or nun from one of the orders that serve in the United States was a rite of passage. Whether in a K-12 classroom or religious education course, nuns were a visible and vibrant component of life in the United States, particularly up through the 1960s or the conclusion of Vatican II. When vocations dropped precipitously for a number of social, economic, cultural, and institutional reasons. As part of the oral history project of Glucksman Iron House, we have heard dozens of stories from nuns and about nuns during our interviews, which are deposited in the archives of Irish America at New York University. The picture that emerges about these women is multifaceted and at times surprising. We decided to share some of these stories because despite the media images of nuns in films like Doubt, Dead Man Walking, or even Sister Act, and the recent exposés of abuse in Catholic institutions, the reality of the work they do, the lives they lead, or the people they touch is not well understood or documented. And as these interviews will suggest, they are as varied and complex as the lay population.
Grammar school was at St. Boniface.
Alice McDermott, author.
And it's the overcrowded, you know, 50 to 70 kids in a class, three classes of each grade. And, you know, again, you look back and you wonder why those poor women who were teaching us were a little bit nuts, you know. No teacher's aides, just a classroom of even 50 first graders, can you imagine?
My Catholic school was, it was a little boot camp for soldiers for Rome.
Tom Kelly, author.
We had nuns and lay teachers. We didn't have brothers or priests. The nuns, I caught the last, even my brother's 5 years younger, had a lot less. We caught the last of, like, the shit-kicking nuns. Mm. I mean, they were old school, and they were tough, and they would, you know, here's the line. I mean, you know, I remember one time we took our jackets off on the playground, and then we had to stand by our desks the entire day, you know. We took our jackets off on the plane. It was that kind of, it was really, you know, it was corporal punishment. They would punch you, they would slap you, they'd hit you with rulers and stuff. The worst they ever did, though, was they'd grab you by the sideburn and just lift you off. And it was, you know, listen, but you got a great education. I mean, and it was a very crowded school at the time. There were a lot of kids. There were probably 40 kids in a class. And there were two classes in each grade. So, and it was just, you know, it was a factory for education. And, you know, I hated it when I was there, although I got very good grades in everything except conduct and handwriting. But you got a great education. And, you know, again, other things you appreciate later, you know. You could just get that eighth grade education and do very well for yourself in this country.
We still had nuns.
Mary Carol French, attorney.
So we had the Sisters of Charity, and half my teachers were nuns, half my teachers were lay teachers. I was never hit. I mean, she kind of pulled hair a little, and if you had long hair, it wasn't really a nice thing. In seventh grade, there was this nun that I didn't care for, and she didn't care for me, and I was sitting in the back with another friend, and she didn't care for him either, and he's one of those kids who matured early, so he's like 6 foot in seventh grade behind this little desk. And I don't know, she asked some question, and he didn't answer it rudely, but it was funny the way he said it, and she got angry, so she kind of whacked him out of the chair. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the, so when you see these things on shows, it's not that far off the mark.
In the 1950s, Catholic schools, staffed primarily by religious orders, educated 11% of American students. But between 1962 and 1992, the population of nuns in America shrank by 42%, and in the same period, not coincidentally, one-third of Catholic schools shut their doors. Today, the number of nuns in this country has dropped to approximately 60,000, down from 180,000 in 1965. More troubling in terms of their service in the community and their personal health care needs is the fact that the majority of these women are older than 65. With few women entering the convent to replenish the population, orders can no longer staff the institutions that thrived 50 years ago or care for the elderly among them. In terms of their presence in the community, the dwindling numbers are compounded by their physical invisibility. In the immediate post-war period before Vatican II, nuns were conspicuous and easily recognized by their flowing robes, or as many school children remember, the clacking of large rosary beads attached to their waists. Some sisters feel strongly that the habit is an important part of their identity, not just for themselves, but for the people they serve. An 84-year-old nun explains why she was still wearing a short veil in 2003. Quote, "People see me, they'd know that somebody is trying to serve God to the best of her ability. And it would make them think that somebody still is trying to practice Christian values. That's why I kept it." Close quote. Although some sisters like her have adopted a modified habit, today the dress code for nuns is considerably relaxed, and often just a religious pin on a blouse collar signifies a sister's position. Yet, even though they are no longer distinguished by their dress in the 21st century, nuns have been shrouded in an air of mystery. Who are these women that live segregated, celibate lives of service in an increasingly secular world? One sister, in an interview with oral historian Carol Garibaldi Rogers, admitted that on her 50th jubilee, she shared family photos with her students to, quote, "tell them that I'm normal, that I wasn't born a nun."
So after John came Marion.
Father John Grange, parish priest.
Who at about the age of 17 or 18 entered the Sisters of Charity. And she took the name Sister Sheila. She was always so thin. And she was a French teacher, and she must have been 80 at least when she died. But the interesting thing about her death is when they put, at least to me, when they put her in the coffin, neither me nor anyone in the family recognized her because she had lipstick on. And she must have never had ever lipstick in her whole life, you know, probably, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was saying, is that really her? Is that really Sister Sheila? But she was a great lady, and she never rose to any eminence, I would say, in the society, but she was good. She influenced a lot of people.
The Sisters of Charity, since they had names like Sister Timothy, Sister Christopher.
John Patrick Shanley, author.
I could, and they were completely hidden except for their faces, I could only surmise their ethnicity for the most part. It turns out that my first grade teacher, Sister James, who then became, when they could take their names again, Sister Peggy McEntee, she turned out to be Irish. But did I know that? She had red hair, and I think you could see just the tiniest, like, quarter inch of it from under her bonnet. Did I know that then? No, I didn't know.
The first Mass, 7:15.
Father Jerry Ryan, parish priest.
Is more for the nuns because, you know, they want to be at Mass before they begin their day. There are three nuns from, what do you call, America? And then we have four Mexican nuns. So there are seven nuns living in the convent. Only one of them is the principal of the school, Sister Grace. And the other two are working in other places. One of them, Juanita, she is our sacristan. And then she takes care of something we call the Sweet 16. They are such lovely people. They're so gentle and so different from Americanos, you know, they're kind of rough and ready, but they and very, very cooperative, ready to do anything the parish would require.
For lay Catholics and sisters in the convent, the results of Vatican II marked a turning point, if not in their faith, then in the way they chose to serve God and practice their religion. Some welcomed the change and the perceived freedoms that new rules represented for 20th century communicants. Others felt that the changes did not go far enough, particularly as regards the role of women in the church and its hierarchy. Coupled with social and economic opportunities emerging for women in the 1960s, life in the church did not hold the same possibility or purpose for young Catholics or women who had already committed their lives to the church.
Certainly the religion that I was brought up with.
Sister Teresa Kelly, Sister of Mercy and Development Director at Our Lady of Mercy Academy.
And the practices that we went through at school were not the same as were given to children after the Vatican. I think things were changed, like processions were limited or done away with. When we were growing up, we always had a 40-hour procession. We had a May procession. And they were always the academy, high school. When we were novices, we would be at the end of the May procession for the girls of Our Lady Mercy Academy. I'm there now 12 years. There's no hurt. No sign of a procession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see? So I think things like that, I don't think were good. I think they thought things were too rigid and therefore they were going to relax them or take away what they thought was the minutiae.
Mm.
And as a result, I think sometimes we threw the baby with the water. I mean, people look at me. I can pass a fire truck or men working on the road and they bless themselves.
Oh.
And I say, now, isn't that what I am really here for?
Right.
No. That they should be kneeling on their knees, but I do remind them there is a life far greater than the one we're all in. Mm-hmm. With all its hard times, it's all worth it all, because someday we'll all be together in that heavenly kingdom. And I think I'm reminding of people that there is a God, there is something greater than what we all, any given day, could be struggling through. So that alone is good for me to be wearing a habit for.
We really, when Vatican II happened
Sister Regina Murphy, Sister of Charity and Property Manager for the Order.
There were the different thrusts to, you know, get in touch with our charism, to deal with structural injustice rather than not just, but more than just feeding people and clothing people. Well, that's good, but to look at why are people hungry? Why are people poor? Why do people not have the basics of life, and try to get at the structures of that? And for a lot of us, that was a very energizing time. You know, there were new ideas, a new theology of mission, just lots of energy in the church. The liturgy was changing, the vernacular and the mass, etc. Those things, the thrust that we take for granted now, were happening. I mean, there were liturgical changes. You can read stuff from the 1930s and 40s, particularly Godfrey Diekmann, who was a Benedictine, writing about liturgy and liturgical changes and the need for the liturgy to be comprehensible to the people in the pew. And, you know, not everybody knows the Latin. And, you know, it was just, so that was happening. So when Vatican II came out with the document on the liturgy, it was, as often happens, law reflecting life. But Vatican II, as Pope John said, opened the windows. And I guess several things. The liturgy, which is so important to so many people, changed, and it was, you know, it was comprehensible and it was alive, and the laity participated so much more. It wasn't this reserved thing for the priest, but the laity were involved and people became readers and Eucharistic ministers and even altar servers.
For all to be true, the road we have followed.
The sisters we spoke to, many of them teachers, remembered lives of work and some adventure, often involving travel to unfamiliar locations teaching students from a variety of ethnic and racial backgrounds. Many of the sisters we spoke to are Irish-born, and like the Mexican sisters Father Jerry Ryan serves within the Bronx, they confronted and were challenged by cultures and customs unfamiliar to them.
I was 18 years in East New York.
Sister Virgilius Reedy, retired Sister of St. Joseph of Peace.
It was, the section was called East New York. And when I was leaving it, I was sent down to Savannah. I was sent to Augusta, Georgia, and then I was sent to Savannah for the next 6.5 years or 7 years. The parents were, most of them were completely from Italy. And they were very anxious that they, of course, they were the first generation of Italians to come to America, and they were very anxious to get their children educated in America. You forgot who we were, that kind of a way. There was also thinking that you were Irish and you were teaching Italian kids, no way.
There were so many that they couldn't fit all the first graders in, 9 to 3. So we had to do, like, I guess it must have been maybe 8:30 to 12, I'm not sure there, but they had to get their time in to do all the, you know, the little ones do, but I can't remember the time sequence. So we did that probably, and then my classroom was probably used by second grade in the afternoon, or the other half of the first grade, you know, so that we were able to take care of, say I had 30 children, we were able to take care of 60. So now in the afternoon I was free. So the principal said, and Sister, you'll teach art in the afternoon to the upper grades. So, but I'm not an artist.
But I had a friend that was ahead of me in the convent, and I said, you know, I have to teach art. I said, would you be able to give me some plates? And I remember years ago, whatever was put up in front of you, you're too young to know that. But when I was growing up, when I was in grade school, the art teacher would put up what they called a plate. And she'd hang this on the room, and she'd say, I'd like you to reproduce this. Now, she'd show you how to begin to do all of this. So, and that was still going on. So she did X amount of plates for me on the back. She said, step one. And there I was, up in the 6th and 7th and 8th grades, and I was barely wet behind the ears, and there I was teaching them art.
The order had decided that...
Sister Noreen Casey, retired Sister of St. Joseph of Peace.
They needed somebody with a master's degree to travel to Savannah, Georgia, because the high school there was being state accredited, and those who didn't have their master's, you had to have a master's degree to teach in high school. So two of us were sent to Savannah. And for the first, about three, we taught in an all-black high school, mm-hmm. co-ed. And then integration came in the end of 1960s into 1970, you remember? It was, I love the youngsters were wonderful. They were giants of boys and girls, you know, beautiful black girls. They had come. We had had three Catholic grade schools. We were the only ones that, not say this, but we used to be called the Negro Nuns, because we were the only ones then that taught. The other nuns weren't teaching the blacks. It wasn't fashionable. For example, if you couldn't sit in the bus if you were traveling with the children to a ball game, they had to sit in the back, yeah. when we first went there. And the conductor would order me to come up to the front. I couldn't leave the girls in the back, or the boys who were, you know, just because of a color that they were discriminated against.
We had no Irish kids.
Sister Rita McCarthy, retired Sister of St. Joseph of Peace.
Maybe one or two dropped in, but ours was an Italian parish in most of the places where we were. Now, we had all different kinds of people in Pittsburgh when I went there. You know, they were from other countries.
There was a lot of German Americans, and there was Polish Americans.
Sister Bernice Murphy, retired Sister of St. Joseph of Peace.
And there was Irish Americans. Very few Italian. I don't think we had many Italian. We had an elementary school from the first to the eighth grade, but we had big classes. We had about 80 children in the classroom, and they were very good. The parents were very good. They saw that they did their homework, and they had no problem at all. They were really very nice children. The people were very nice.
Even though their numbers have diminished, nuns remain a presence in the church, continuing to work in schools and communities across the economic spectrum and throughout the United States. Such is the power of their influence, the memory of their classroom discipline, and the respect or fear they commanded in their duties, that most who have crossed their path have a story to tell, for better or for worse. Tales of a withering look or a stinging rap with the ruler are legendary, and many are true. But any number of interviewees we spoke to offer stories of compassion and inspiration about these women. John Patrick Shanley dedicated Doubt to the, quote, many orders of Catholic nuns who have devoted their lives to serving others in hospitals, schools, and retirement homes. Though they have been much maligned and ridiculed, who among us have been so generous?
You know, it's the sort of thing, all right, maybe even the majority of them failed in some way. Maybe they lost that initial ambition, or they were overwhelmed, more than likely,
yeah.
overworked and overwhelmed and became bitter. But it started with, you know, their vocation started with something remarkable, that they had the wherewithal and the determination to do that. And I think that's the part that's not recognized, you know. So they beat kids and they said stupid things, and they probably drove more people out of the church than brought them in. Mm-hmm. Many of them, and many just the opposite. But even for the worst of them, you know, even for the craziest of nuns, who, you know, the popular culture loves to make use of, somewhere there was that initial tremendous calling or ambition that they and the belief that they could do it, whether they did or not, somewhere in their careers they had the confidence to say, I can give my life, my whole life to this. That's a remarkable thing.
For Glucksman Island House, this is Linda Dowling Almeida.
We have followed, you can't go alone, bring other men with us in love, in joy. We know where we're going, our road we have found, at the end there's a rainbow of joy, for the sun is now shining.
So I'm here at 1 Washington Mews at Glucksman Ireland House NYU with my colleague and friend Dr. Linda Dowling Almeida, who has been on the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour in the past. Welcome back, Linda, and thanks for sitting down with
thanks,
me.
Mary.
You wear multiple hats. I think I've mentioned that before when we've spoken, and I want to talk to you today about your role as editor of the American Journal of Irish Studies, and I suppose more particularly Volume 11, 2014, is hot off the press here. And can you just tell me a little bit about the experience of editing another volume of AJIS and how it's going for you generally?
Well, I feel like this is another free education that I'm receiving as I put together all of these journals, just because I have the privilege of reading all of the documents that come in before they're edited and cleaned up and put to press. So, you know, with each volume, I learned something more about any number of areas in Irish history and literature on both sides of the Atlantic. And this one, in particular, is very wide-ranging, from Mother Jones to 18th-century lawyer and pamphleteer to the horse industry in New York and actors. I mean, it just runs the gamut. So it's fun, but it's also really eye-opening in terms of the things I've learned working on the journal.
So how long does the process take, Linda, in terms of getting a volume together?
I'd say anywhere from, 3 to 6 months, you know, from the time we get a manuscript in and we read through it, we go back and forth with the editor, you know, the editing process, having different people look at it, and then just the nitty-gritty of the review. They say the devil's in the details. So the longest part is really the reviewing and fact-checking and doing all the grammatical and typo stuff that needs to be done.
And we're really in a position right now with the journal, Linda, and we're very lucky, I suppose, to be in that position where almost all the content, if not all of it, most of it is generated within Glucksman Ireland House in terms of the public events and conferences that we hold.
Yeah, we're lucky now where we don't really have to go outside for most of our content. We feature all of the named lectures we sponsor during the year, and that's really nice, particularly for our members, because if they can't get to every event, or you know how you're sitting in a presentation and you say, oh, I wish I wrote that down, or I wish I had a note to jot down some ideas or some new facts. This way, we're able to recreate the presentation for our readers and include some illustrations, and then along the way pick up some other interesting features, including our oral history feature, which is standard, where we pick a topic from our archive and focus on that and pull out some excerpts from the interview to make a point about some theme. In this issue, it's to compliment Hilary Sweeney's piece on the history of horses in New York City and the history of the Irish who work with the horses in New York City. And with the mayor's issue with the horse and carriages up in Central Park, it seemed a great opportunity for us to go out and talk to some of the drivers and learn that the Irish are still very much involved in that business. So that was fun.
Yeah, it's been great. Linda, as you know, the lovely podcast you put together with Michael Stallmeyer as well ran on the Glucksman Ireland House Radio Hour there before Christmas and is available through the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour archive and through our links to our podcasts, which are up on the Glucksman Ireland House website. If anyone missed that and wants to go back and have a listen, it's really nicely done. And we did have Hilary in talking to us as well about her article on that very topic. Maybe, Linda, if you wouldn't mind, could we take a kind of journey through the lineup of content in the volume? And I see that we start off the first major article in Volume 11 of the American Journal of Irish Studies is an article which drew actually from a public event the 15th Ernie O'Malley lecture of 2013, and which was actually, I had the pleasure of sharing the audio of that lecture with Professor Elliot Gorn. The paper's entitled Mother Jones, Ireland to North America to Ireland. Tell us a little bit about what you learned about this fascinating research on Mother Jones, Linda.
Well, Mother Jones has always been an iconic figure in America among labor historians. She was a rabble-rouser, spokesperson for trade unionists, and particularly for child labor advocates. What was interesting in Professor Gorn's treatment of her was that he was able to trace her life's history and link her activism back to Ireland and the family's history as refugees from the famine and some of the hardships she witnessed in Ireland as a young girl, and the fact that her family basically split up. Her father and brother came to Canada, you know, ahead of her mother and sisters. She traveled to Toronto, worked there for a while, and she lived a very long, difficult life. She was educated, started as a teacher, got married, moved to Tennessee, lost her children and her husband in an epidemic, moved back to Chicago, started a seamstress business with a friend, lost that completely in the Chicago fire, and then went underground for a bit and emerged at the turn of the century as this labor leader. But what she had done in the meantime was construct this persona. And if you've ever seen pictures of her, she's this seemingly harmless little woman in black with twinkly eyes and the round granny glasses. But it was a very, according to Professor Gorn, a very deliberate composition of a role she played as the mother of the working class, as mother of labor union and agitation. And apparently she spoke like a truck driver. She's this sweet little woman, but was tough as nails and came up against some of the strongest and most powerful men and business leaders in the country and stood her ground. So it was kind of interesting the way he linked her role in labor back to Ireland, that experience sowed the seed of her awareness of the hardship of the poor and what was needed to bring attention to the fact that they needed to be treated fairly, and then just her whole persona. The other thing that was really interesting is that she lied about her age to make herself older. So she really fanned the fires of that grandmother, Mother Jones, identity that she created. It was really interesting, really, really interesting.
It's fascinatingly done.
Great photos, too, that he helped me find.
Right, yeah. I have to say I was really struck by his delivery that night. I really enjoyed that lecture. Mm. I happened to be at it and really enjoyed it. I don't know whether I had an opportunity to mention this to you, Linda. You know, her whole background and everything, it's so fascinating, and how Professor Gorn, as you say, draws out the context of her background and her influence. And it made me think about, in a very different setting, you know, he's born in the United States. I'm now talking about Henry Ford, who had a massive impact on labor worldwide and in the United States a bit later on, but is the son of Irish immigrants from Cork.
She's from Cork.
We estimate what she's born around 1830, and she comes to this country. Henry Ford is born here because his father comes in 1847. But here are these two people who have radically different outlooks and influences, but they come from this small little place in Ireland, relatively speaking.
And what's weird about Ford is, even though he would object to labor unions and was insulted when his workers tried to organize, he was actually quite fair to his working force and increased their wages exponentially to keep them happy and also enable them to buy the product that they were producing. So it's really interesting.
Well, and also in terms of their actual migration trajectory, and again, now I'm not talking about Henry Ford himself, I'm talking about his father, William Ford, but like the Harrises, they come in through Canada and down into the United States. I mean, it's not, you and I are familiar enough with 19th century migration patterns to know that that wasn't so untypical at all, but it's just very interesting to think about this relatively small county. I mean, it is Ireland's largest county, and the huge influence they've had in the United States on labor generally, you know. So, you know, Mother Jones, I kind of digress there a little bit with the Ford thing, but for any of you folks who didn't have the opportunity to hear the Ernie O'Malley lecture delivered by Professor Gorn, either in person or on the radio program when we aired it there a few months ago, do have a read of this article. He does a really nice job at distilling this research. So the next one we move on to then, Linda, tell me a little bit about the next article in Volume 11 of the American Journal.
He Carol McCall is a, what they would call a presenter, we would call a news anchor in Ireland, and on their most popular morning news show, the equivalent of Today or Good Morning America. I've never seen him. Did you?
Yeah, on radio. Yeah, okay. So he's more radio than television. It's probably the most listened to radio program. It's definitely, I'd say, the most listened to current affairs program, okay. Or, you know, but I think it actually is probably that Morning Ireland, as it's called, slot. He's been on it for as long as I can remember. So the article is called Good Morning, First the Bad News, Reflections of a Morning Ireland Presenter. So that was delivered as part of the 7th Irish Institute lecture in 2013.
Right, just 2 years ago, a year and a half ago now. His point was just talking about the critical role of media in presenting news, which seems an unnecessary kind of duh. Well, isn't that the case? But just in a post-Celtic Tiger world, he was talking about how very sensitive journalists in Ireland have become because of the tough times and the cynicism that's developed among the Irish public as to the news that's being delivered, that they're critical if they're not tough enough on people, if they're too soft. So, you know, the balance that needs to be struck as an anchor, and how sometimes in the heat of the moment, in terms of anger against the banking industry or against the Catholic Church, where the news media have been too quick to make a judgment about someone without checking all the facts. And in a 24-hour news cycle, he was sort of reflecting on how important it is to give pause and make sure that the facts are correct, because the news people in a program like this, it's such an intimate part of the listening public's life, that they take very seriously the news that's delivered. And he says, despite what some people may think, journalists take their role very seriously. So, and then he had a couple of ideas for issues that will be coming up in the future, things that the media need to be aware of, you know, going forward, including the fact that Ireland is now a very multicultural, more diverse population than it was even 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And how does that affect news delivery or the stories that are being covered?
Well, he's a very respected journalist. Linda, I happen to personally very much admire his career and everything. And it's also very interesting, I think, kind of as a historical document to get someone like him of his caliber. And I know at first when we approached him and invited him to talk, even though he speaks in the morning to millions of listeners every day, the way we are asking him to actually contextualize that and distill down aspects of what he does through a very historic period. I mean, he reported right through the Troubles, you know, if I remember correctly, he goes back to the late 70s or early 80s in terms of his journalistic career. So he's really been an eyewitness to history in a way that I actually think even now we don't fully appreciate. I think it was a really nice intervention for us to get him to come and talk in that way.
Yeah, sometimes with journalism, I know when I was doing my initial work in the 1980s with the New Irish, the issue from an historical point of view was that it was too current, that there wasn't enough perspective, and I think he may have felt a little bit of that. But I think it's so important that as the news is happening, to get it as it happens, because it provides a perspective that's so fresh, you can't get it when you look back 20 years, and that's helpful too, I think.
Absolutely, and it's a snapshot as well of an outlook. I even noticed myself, Linda, I don't know that I've ever mentioned that to you, interviews and oral histories that I collected in 2006, and we had a certain outlook in terms of Irish emigration. We didn't think people would be leaving in big numbers anytime. We never anticipated, you know,
And on the Irish side.
And well, it was from an Irish American perspective or doing interviews in London with people of Irish descent. We never anticipated that there would be a huge downturn in 2008, and all of a sudden thousands, literally thousands of Irish immigrants would leave Ireland again. And when you go back and listen to my interviews now, you can hear that in the interview.
Oh,
and
this
is only 6 years, 8 years later.
I know. So things change so, so quickly.
Absolutely. The next article, Linda, if you could tell me a little bit about Rights Revolution Republics, 1750 to 1850, The Work and Works of William Sampson, 1764 to 1836, A Chronology. That's by Professor Walter J. Walsh.
Yes, this is one of a tandem of articles, the next one by Brian McMahon. And they both came out of a conference that was held here at our own house last April, I believe, and it had to do with the 200th anniversary of People v. Phillips ruling that really set the standard for the priest penitent privilege in American trial law, where it is the conversations that take place within the confessional are held sacred and the priest does not have to reveal what he's heard in there. The work that Walter did on William Sampson had to do with his life's work. Sampson was the lawyer and then a quote-unquote pamphleteer or chronicler of legal events in Ireland and the United States. He started in Ireland, was from a Protestant background, but was agitating for Catholic rights. And he became quite a dangerous person because he would record trials and then reproduce them. His greatest skill, they said, was because he could take stenography. So he would transcribe the proceedings of a trial and report on them, and then also publish sort of satirical pamphlets on different issues of the day. So he was eventually driven out of Ireland into New York, and when he got here, he got involved in the Sampson case in 1813. And what Walter's done is he creates a chronology of his life and work, and personally and professionally, from his time as a young lawyer in Ireland through his exile into France and then over here to the United States, winding up with the fact that his daughter marries Wolf Tone's son, which is a kind of interesting marriage of revolutionaries.
I didn't know about that connection. Interesting.
Yeah.
So then in Brian McMahon's article, Brian has had a really stellar career in justice in Ireland as our equivalent of a Supreme Court judge. I can't remember the word. I've been here too long now that I can't remember that. So his article, though, is People v. Phillips in Light of Contemporary Developments in Ireland and the U.S.
What he does is he takes the privilege that People v. Phillips brought to American law and brings it forward and tries to contextualize its place in Irish law in terms of whether a similar privilege exists within the realm of Irish law. And the perception of privilege is skewed a little differently in terms of the institution versus the person in Ireland, but he sort of goes through how it had some effect on decisions in Ireland, you know, in terms of priest-penitent privilege and then going forward into other religions in Ireland. So it's kind of an interesting look at how the laws are different and similar and how they apply in contemporary Ireland, at least since the post-war period.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. It's interesting to think of it in the context of Sampson's influence coming from the Irish background and what's going back across the Atlantic in the other direction, or, you know, how they're feeding off each other.
And also how Sampson, as a Protestant, understood that it was the right thing to do to protect Catholic rights. You know, so there was that twist, too. You forget how many people who were involved in the Catholic rights movement in Ireland were not all Catholic. Mm-hmm. So I think that was kind of interesting, too.
So the next article in Volume 11 is by former Minister for Education, Mary Hanafin, Irish Education, Rising to the Challenge. Tell us a little bit about this piece, Linda.
Yeah, she came to speak to us a couple of years ago in one spring, and I sat in on the presentation, and I was really taken with what she had to say about the demands that the educational system in Ireland faced in the wake of the 2008 banking and real estate crisis. And she talked about, because I was always struck by the quality of Irish education. That's always been one of the reasons the Irish economy is successful when it's successful, and why Irish workers in Ireland and in the United States are usually so much in demand, is because of the high quality of their education. And she just talked a bit about how in, you know, that post-Celtic Tiger world, things may have to change because of the monies available, because of the diversity in the economy, because the small schoolhouse may not be as economically viable as it was 20 or 30 years ago. So in order to keep the vibrancy of the economy and that sort of formula that the Irish have of the good education equaling good workers equaling good economy, what the country is facing in terms of making changes to adjust to the diversity in the population, the changes in skill sets that young people need leaving college, and the rest of that, those is a very, very interesting perspective on that.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of Irish people who, you know, it's only when they leave Ireland that they really realize, how fortunate we are in Ireland to have you know, historically have had access to quite, well, at least say since the late 1960s mm-hmm. or so, you know,
right.
relatively inexpensive or free second level education, and then in more recent decades as well, how accessible third level education has been.
Mm-hmm.
A country like the United States, where people are going into huge debt, it's a real wake up call. So I agree, it was a very interesting perspective and an interesting time to actually hear Mary Hanafin speak as well, because it looks like she's getting back into the political arena at home now more recently. So we probably caught her at the right time. So the next article is Hilary J. Sweeney's one on the workhorse and the relationship between the Irish community in New York and the horse in New York. And we've talked quite a bit about that. So maybe we'll jump on to the next article, which is by another alum of mm-hmm. the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies, Daphne Dyer Wolfe, who's currently undertaking her PhD at Drew University,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So her article is Politics and the Playhouses, Charles Aaron Verner's Eviction and the Construction of Irish-American Identity. Tell us a bit about this, Linda.
This was really kind of a fun piece, I thought, you know, without taking away from her, the work she did, the scholarly work that she did. Verner is a late 19th century showman, writer, actor. She would call him an entrepreneur as well as a member of the theater community. But what he did was he sort of co-opted a play, Eviction, that took advantage or played on the sympathies of American audiences who were very much riled up about the famine refugees and the land wars in Ireland. So he took advantage of that sort of political bent among members of the Irish American community and created a play that appealed to those emotions in the United States. And he traveled around the country with the piece. While she does not have a transcript or a copy of the script, what she's been able to do, which I thought was really clever, is take snippets from broadsides published at the time about the different acts in the play, and she was able to lay it alongside another play called The Eviction, which she suggests he, Vermeer here, lifted from another writer, another playwright, and used to his advantage. And he followed, the other thing he does is he goes to cities where he knows people like Parnell are visiting, or other Home Rule and Land League representatives are speaking, to sort of exploit the temperament of the time. So it was a very interesting article about a man who proves to be quite elusive, and even she's not sure that his middle name, which he posts as Aaron, is actually true. He's got several different versions of his birth certificate. So he's a bit of a showman, a marketer, a very savvy businessman, just taking advantage of an opportunity and exploiting it. It is really interesting, really well done.
And it's great to see that classic example of someone kind of rescuing an individual from obscurity. So just to finish up, Linda, towards the rest of the journal you devote to the archives. Just tell us a little bit, for people who are interested in picking up the journal, what's in store in terms of what you cover there.
Well, what we're going to do going forward is we're going to have a short feature about the archives, just to introduce our readers to the kind of holdings we have there. The first featured holding are those of the papers of Frank Durkin. He's a well-known and very well-liked lawyer in the area who's related to the O'Dwyer brothers of great fame, Paul O'Dwyer and William O'Dwyer. So we, you know, list all the holdings that we have there just to give people an idea of the type of depth of research they can do within our archive. And then the other piece we do is the oral history. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a complement to Hillary's piece on the horses. And what we've done is, from the interviews that we went out and conducted that we use for our podcast and that we've got in the archive, we spoke to stable owners, drivers, a farrier. We even spent part of an interview with the farrier as a horseshoer, with Eddie Hayes, he's the farrier, as he goes through the process of shoeing a horse, which is fascinating. Just the sounds, the tools, what it takes, how the process has really not changed since the time that his grandfather was shoeing horses at the turn of the century. So it was kind of an interesting look to see that not only are the Irish still involved in the business, but some of them are several generations deep into the business.
Well, it's wonderful research, Linda, and I commend you on putting pulling together the various strands you have done in that sense, in terms of highlighting the Irish and the horse carriage industry through, you know, what's in this edition of the journal and also through the podcast and oral history dimension. It's really, really fascinating to contextualise what I think will be much discussed again in the months and weeks ahead. Listen, Linda, thanks for coming in. I suppose volume 12 is on the horizon.
Should be out in the fall.
Great.
So we're starting work on that.
And if anyone wants to pick up a copy of the American Journal of Irish Studies, I guess the best thing is to shoot us an email here.
You can go to our website. We have a link to the journal and we have order forms on the website, or you can give us a call.
Okay.
And we'll walk you through it.
Absolutely. So if anyone's interested, you can give us a call at 212-998-3950 or send us an email at ireland.house@nyu.edu. Or alternatively, probably the easiest thing is to go to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU website and click through to the order form there. If you go to the publications tab, you'll be prompted through to the American Journal of Irish Studies. Congratulations, Cohorticus, Linda. It's a lovely publication and delighted to see you shepherding it through to this point, and hopefully you can relax now for a while before you get too busy with the next one. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Interested in chamber orchestra and hearing some new works for chamber orchestra by composers from the US and Ireland, there's a lovely event, a free event coming up actually, on Sunday, February 15th at 3 p.m. It's called a Midwinter Fest, and Frank Corcoran, who is a well-known Irish composer, a musician who is based in Germany, will be here with some other friends, Max Lifschitz, Terry Riley, William Schmill and Thomas Whitman, and they will be performing the Midwinter Fest at Christ and St. Stephen's Church, which is on 120 West 69th Street between Broadway and Columbus in New York City, at 3 p.m. on Sunday, February 15th. So if any of you are interested in hearing some really dynamic new music from composers from both sides of the Atlantic, do pop along to that. We're coming towards the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Knighton, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and on HD Radio and on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour and on irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu and our phone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to nyuirish.net/radiohour or to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Sandley Show up next on WBNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening to irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus fanacht.